we're in 1 Kings chapter 19 now, which we started reading a little bit at the end of our time last week, so we want to resume from there, but we want to start and go ahead and read what we read last week so we can catch the context here. Let's read verses 1 through 3. From 1 Kings 19, Brother Trey, can you read that for us, please?
And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and all the priests and all the prophets of Israel. And Jezebel sent the messenger to Elijah, saying, "Look, the God of beauty and more awesome, but make not thy life as the life of one of them, all of his time." When he saw that, he arose from his life and came to worship him, and belonged to the temple of the servant there.
All right, so Ahab goes home after the events there from chapter 18 when God sent fire down from the sky and burnt up the sacrifice that Elijah had prepared on the Lord's altar and at Carmel, and then it licked up the, burnt the sacrifice, water, stones, all of that. So God performed a great miracle before all the people so that they recognized that Jehovah was God and Baal was not, and that Baal's prophets were false, and that Elijah was speaking the word of the true and only God of heaven. And that was acknowledged there, and that was what brought the famine to an end when God decided to bring rain. So Ahab was sent back to Jezreel, and so he returns back to his home, and when he gets there, he tells on Elijah, and so he goes and tells Jezebel, and it's interesting here when he says, and told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and with all how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. So all that we saw there in chapter 18 is the take-home message. Here's what Elijah did. Would that be a good heading for a description, a summary of the events of 1 Kings chapter 18, what Elijah did? I guess that's about all you're left with, isn't it? Which is where they were with the start, which is why God did all that he did in chapter 18 to show the foolishness and the falsehood of all of that. That's the perspective that Ahab, and of course Jezebel, we can tell she is viewing it the same way with the oath that she swears in verse 2 when she hears about this. Is there any credit to God? Did Elijah go and say, "You would not believe," of course you wouldn't, another way of phrasing that, "you should have been there to see what Jehovah did, and what he proved about Elijah, and what he proved about Baal." You know, we were so wrong when we thought, and when we've been worshiping him and listening to these prophets that sit at your table. But of course, we know what the problem was. Is this a strong delusion? Using the term from that the Lord uses in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 10, "Those who do not receive a love of the truth," he says, "that God will send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie." So when someone rejects God, and we all know that we have a maker, that's revealed to us all through the creation, as we know. So there's not a person that lives that does not know that they have a creator, and that we should therefore and are obligated to and have no excuse for not seeking our Creator's will, seeking God to live for Him, to serve Him. But those who then reject their Maker and do not like to retain Him in their knowledge and are determined they're going to live their lives their way and not serve their Maker, when they don't love that truth that they have a creator and an owner that they should and must live for and serve, then what does God do? Well, he does send a strong delusion. And how how strong would it be to see what God just did in 1 Kings 18 with fire coming down from the sky when Elijah's praying for God to do that, to see the failure of Baal's so-called prophets, to see what that fire come down and devour that sacrifice and burn up and consume the stones and the water and all of that, to see that and not to be convinced about who God is. I mean, that would take a strong delusion, wouldn't it? Well, how about a stronger one? What happened in 1 Kings 18, how does that compare to the works of Christ? That's not too minimum. I mean, this was a work of God in 1 Kings 18 for certain. It was a miracle. But looking at all the miracles that Christ did, when you look at the volume, the magnitude of those miracles, what kind of witness did God bear to his son compared to what he bore to Elijah? I mean, did he bear sufficient witness to Elijah that everyone was responsible for recognizing that he was like that woman in Zarephath said in 1 Kings 17:24, that she knew that he was a prophet of the Lord, and that the word in his mouth that he was speaking was the truth. I mean, did God bear sufficient witness to Elijah to prove that? He certainly did. Did he bear witness to his son in an even greater fashion? He did. He bore the greatest witness to his son, and for a reason. Now, the ones who were present at the time of Christ, how many miracles did they see? I mean, there's a reason why in Matthew chapter 11, when Jesus was upbraiding the cities of Galilee, where did Jesus do most of his preaching and where were most of his miracles done? In Galilee. I mean, yes, he went to Jerusalem for the feasts every year, and he taught in Jerusalem, taught in the temple, did many miracles there. But the vast majority of his work and his preaching and teaching and the miracles that he did was in Galilee. And so those cities of Galilee, including his hometown of Nazareth, but Bethsaida, Chorazin, and Capernaum, what did he say about those cities? He said, woe to them because of all that they had seen and they didn't repent. And compared to what, well, he said if Sodom and Gomorrah had, if they had that witness was so strong that what God bore to Christ, Jesus said that would have even brought Sodom and Gomorrah to repentance. But those people to reject all of that, how strong was their delusion? That's also what Jesus speaks about in John chapter 12, if we can go there for a moment, in the Gospel of John chapter 12. And he was looking at these people and speaking about these people that rejected those miracles. Verses, if we can look at verses 37 through 41, John 12, 37 to 41. See, George, you got that? So verse 37, it says, though he had done so many miracles before them. What does that mean, before them?
Around them.
Right in front of their face. I mean, they were there. They were witnesses to it. That's what that means. It was before them, right in front of their eyes. They saw them. It wasn't that they just heard about what he had done. They saw it. They saw all those miracles. They were there. But even though he did all those miracles right in front of them, what happened? This is speaking about their leaders primarily, but they didn't believe on him in spite of that. And what did that fulfill? That fulfilled a prophecy, and that's a quotation from Isaiah 53, verse 1, there in verse 38, that he would not be believed. So they fulfilled that prophecy. That's certainly not a prophecy anyone should have desired to be guilty of fulfilling if they had any wisdom, but they didn't. So they fulfilled that prophecy of Christ's rejection, but why? Well, that fulfilled another prophecy that he quotes there in verses 39 and 40. Well, he says in verse 39, they could not believe. And the reason is what Isaiah had prophesied about them. They could not believe, even though they saw those miracles, they were incapable of believing as long as what verse 40 speaks about was taking place. That's the strong delusion. When he says he shall send them strong delusion, they should believe a lie. That's the process he's describing like that the Lord prophesied about. That he blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts so that they wouldn't see. Well, at first glance, if we don't study the rest of what God teaches in his word, somebody might read that and be a bit perplexed or confused. Well, I thought it was God's will that everybody should be converted and healed. Well, of course it is. I mean, first, the ultimate will of God, 1 Timothy 2, verse 4, is that he would have all men to believe and come to the knowledge of the truth. Or 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9, that he would have all to come to repentance. I mean, that is God's ultimate desire, that everyone that he's made in his image, every human being would be converted, that they would be saved. And what has he done to make that happen? Well, he's revealed himself to everybody from the creation. Is that fair? He's done it for everybody. So no one has an excuse. And then he gave his own son for the whole world, everybody, so they could be saved. So God has done his work to make that possible for everyone, and that's his desire. But after that, the next step is whose? When we've been given that knowledge to hold in our hand, that knowledge, that truth that we have a creator to that we should seek, then what we do with that knowledge that we're holding is going to determine what God does next, whether we hold that truth in righteousness or unrighteousness. Now, holding it in righteousness, and of course, that's the language from Romans 1, 18 through 21. But God's anger is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. And he speaks about that which may be known of him, of the invisible things of him, even his eternal power and Godhead, that he's made, that he's revealed all by the creation, by the things that are made, that he says are clearly seen by that. So they're without excuse. But when they knew God, he says they glorified him not as God. That's the problem. So that's how they held the truth in unrighteousness. They wouldn't glorify him. They wouldn't seek him and live for him only. Well, when man decides that, that's the rejection. That's the receiving not the love of that truth. That's when the strong delusion comes. So God desires everyone to be saved, but he does give us that choice of whether we are going to love that truth that we have a creator to serve, and that we have a choice then to do that. That's God's will that we have that choice. When we make the wrong choice there and we reject him, then what comes next? Well, then that's when this happens. And when that strong delusion comes, I mean, that's why it's senseless to argue, and why the Lord tells us to not cast our pearls before swine or give that which is holy to the dogs. When someone is in that situation, if we're arguing with them, I mean, what argument could I come up with to convince someone that has a delusion so strong that they could witness all the miracles that Jesus did with their own eyes and still couldn't believe? What can I possibly say that's going to convince them? Or what could you possibly say that's going to convince somebody that's got that kind of a strong delusion? Is there anything? So, I mean, so what's the point of arguing with somebody in that situation? Does it make us feel better to have the argument, or later on to be able to reflect back on how we said all the convincing things that showed that we were right? I mean, there's no point to it. That's why the Lord tells us not to do that. They'll turn again and rend us. So when we recognize somebody's got that problem, I mean, that trying to get into a big argument is not going to help, because I take away the strong delusion the Lord has given? That's another way of asking that. Do I have that power? No. But is there any way for that to happen then? Well, rather than argue with them, what do we need to do? If we understand the process, then the way we deal with people in the world is to try to deal with that issue, which is what 2 Corinthians chapter 3 tells us. So when God sends that strong delusion, or when somebody is like Ahab and Jezebel, I mean, there's a strong delusion. That's what we're talking about this. To see after all that happened in 1 Kings 18, and all they're thinking about is, look at what Elijah did. I mean, that shows the strong delusion they had. Well, when dealing with ones that are like that, if Elijah showed up at Jezreel at the palace and argued well enough, could he convince them? Could he convert them? No. So what does that mean, that God is no longer going to, at the first moment when we understand that we have a creator, we reject him? How many people, from the very first moment they realize about their God, that they turn to him and seek him and live for him with all their heart from that first moment, and there's never any, there's no period of rejection, there's no period of really being lost. I mean, does that happen? Or does it just, I mean, look at ourselves. I mean, we all had our time, didn't we? When we weren't doing well spiritually. So from that standpoint, when we ask the question, well, does God just, does he give up on and give no more opportunities for anyone that makes that initial rejection? Well, none of us would be in here right now if that were so. So does God continue to try to work with ones who've made that rejection to get them to come to that acknowledgement? Well, we recently studied about that, and knowing that the Lord is God, we saw the example of Manasseh, and there was Saul of Tarsus. I mean, look at those two, one from the Old Testament, one from the New. Look at all the things that they got involved in, contrary to the will of God. But God reached them. God continued to work with them. Now, is there a point at which he won't? Yes. But God's going to give many opportunities. And if at any point through that process, even through that delusion, when God is showing them or giving some way in which he's reminding them, you have a creator you should serve. If at any point there, that they start to feel after him, as Paul was speaking of on Mars Hill in Acts 17, if anybody starts to feel after him, is he far from any one of us? He's not. And then 2 Corinthians chapter 3, he shows us that how this works. Let's look at verse 14 of 2 Corinthians chapter 14 through 16 of 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Brother Samuel, can you read that? Why does it say it instead of he? He's talking about their heart. Exactly. When the heart turns to the Lord, then the veil is going to be taken away. That strong delusion that God gave, can he take it away? Will he do it? Here we are. But it requires that heart to turn to the Lord for that rejection to end, for that feeling after him to begin, and then God's going to respond to that. And then if we will continue that seeking, and turn away from that rejection that we gave before, then he'll remove the blinders. Then he'll take away that strong delusion. But there's that process, and of course, as the rejection goes time after time after time, after opportunity after opportunity after opportunity that the Lord gives, I mean, eventually God's working them under their footstool. They're going to run out of those opportunities. There's going to be the time when God said, that's it. Did Ahab and Jezebel reach that point? Yes, they did. But when we're dealing with somebody in the world, I mean, they had that strong delusion. We need to remember that. So if trying to argue with them over doctrinal points is not going to get anywhere. But what we need to do is try to deal with them on that issue of we have a maker that we need to seek after and serve. That's the only thing that's going to get God to take away that delusion, if they will acknowledge that and start to feel after him. So we need to keep that in mind. But Elijah and Jezebel are some of the clearest examples of those with strong delusion to come out of, for Ahab to come back to Jezreel from Carmel, seeing what he had just seen, and say, look, here's what Elijah did. So then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah and said, so let the gods do to me and more also if I make not your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. So she swore an oath, actually invoking a curse upon herself if what happened to her prophets didn't happen to him by the same time, within 24 hours. Well, it didn't. So if Jezebel's actual request had been granted, she would have come to the same end, and she would have been hacked by the sword within after that 24 hours, wouldn't she? But was she going to really, did she really want that to happen? No. So she's promising to get Elijah. Now, what did Elijah do when he heard that? Yes, and where did he go to? And where in Judah? Why Judah, and why the place in Judah that he went to? Yeah, where is that? When the Lord speaks about what encompasses the whole land of Israel, he'll say from where to where? Dan's up here. Beersheba's down here. You cannot go further south. I mean, where's Ahab? Where's his kingdom? See, here's Carmel, where he just was, where those things happened. And then you have Jezreel over here in the middle there. I mean, this is Ahab land up here. And this is where Ahab and Jezebel are. This is where Elijah's just been. This threat comes directly from Jezebel to Elijah. And, Elijah himself, after going to Carmel, he ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. So he's gone there too. So here's where he is now. So he's nearby enough where a messenger can get to him from Jezebel with this warning and threat. She intends to have him dead within 24 hours. I mean, immediately. So he goes down here. All right, so first of all, that gets him out of the kingdom that Ahab, the territory that he reigns over. This is now in Judah, different king. But not just getting out of Ahab's kingdom, getting into Judah, the other kingdom, that at this time, who's the king there? Asa. What kind of king is he? What's that? We're getting close here to Jehoshaphat, Tom, Asa's son, which of course he's a righteous king too. So there's a righteous king in Judah this time that's serving the Lord. So it's not like he's going to go there and then he's immediately going to be betrayed because everybody in Judah loves Ahab. No, he's fleeing from a kingdom ruled by a wicked man to go to a kingdom that has a righteous king. But he goes all the way to Beersheba, which is at the very bottom of Israel. You can't go further south than that and still be in Israel. In fact, you're going to end up in the water. So that's the end of Israel. So he's gone as far away, physically as far away in Israel as he can get from Ahab and Jezebel. This brings up an interesting point. That's actually a relevant point to a lot of things, but even some of the stuff that's going on that's our country, the world in a grip right now with the coronavirus going around. There's some basic fundamental truths. It was true for Elijah then, it's true for us today. verse 10. Let's read that. Who's in control of our life? Job chapter 12, verse 10. Let's see, Brother Michael, can you read that?
Whose hand is the soul of every living thing and the breath of all mankind?
Speaking of God. Not just ourselves, but every living thing. Well, Jesus also said that. Does even a sparrow fall without the Father? So the life of every bird, the life of every living thing, and certainly our souls are in the hands of God. Nothing can or will happen to us that's outside of the will of God. Just as not a sparrow is going to fall, we won't either. It has to be God's decision. Jezebel, if Elijah's hand, breath, if his life were not in God's hands, then, well, he would have already been dead. I mean, how much effort have they already gone to hunt him down and find him and have him killed? All through those years, the 3.5 years of the famine. They'd already been doing that. But now the efforts are going to be even greater because he's had Jezebel's prophets killed. It was the people that went along with that because of what they just saw from the witness that God bore. But, of course, that's being ignored, that lesson not learned by Ahab and especially Jezebel. She wants vengeance. She wants him dead because her prophets are dead. She's blaming him as if a man did all this himself. But Elijah's breath, his life is in God's hand. It certainly was. That's why he was still alive, and that's why he continued to live. That's why Jezebel's efforts failed. That's also what the Lord teaches us, reminds us of in James chapter 4. If we can go there and read 13 through 16. But Caleb, can you read that for us? James 4, 13 through 16. What power do we have to do anything? And we do talk about people's will to live, things like that. And if somebody just gives up, can that make a difference? Yeah. But can we will ourselves to remain alive? I mean, if I just try hard enough, can I make myself live another moment? Not one. Not a single one. I can't take an extra breath because of my will to do so. We have no power. We didn't give ourselves our life to begin with. God gave it. God will take it when it's his time. But it's only if he wills that we're going to continue to live and do this or that, whatever it is that we do. You know, we make our plans. We have our desires or goals. And we all wanted to be here this morning. And by God's will and his mercy and love, here we are. And could we get ourselves here by our own will? Could we make that happen? Or is it because it was the will of God that he preserved us all and got us here safely and well, where we could be here right now doing what we desire to do? But if it's not, we won't be here. I mean, it wasn't Brother Glenn's desire or his goal or plan to be in the hospital this morning. Just as an example, he wanted to be here with us too. And I'm sorry he's not, as he is. But we understand that sometimes, you know, here's our will, but it's not God's will. But everything has got to be according to his will. And we don't have power on our own to do or not do anything. It's only if he wills. If any of us gets the coronavirus or not, I mean, that's got to be by God's will either way. All right, now that being the case, understanding that, does that mean, since everything is up to God in the end, that we don't have to do anything in any situation because it's all going to be in God's hands anyhow? No. Example right here, Jezebel threatened Elijah. Well, did he just sit there in Jezreel and say, my life's in God's hands, I don't have to go anywhere? No, he went all the way down. Beersheba for a reason. Well, if anybody was to think, well, Elijah's just showing a weakness in his faith here. No. What did Jesus do in John 8:59? Let's go read that. John chapter 8, verse 59. Brother Peter. He had a few Jezebels after him and Ahabs. John 8:59.
They took the hail stones and cast that to cast at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by.
All right. Well, did Jesus make any effort to hide himself when they were trying to kill him? He did, just like Elijah did. So is that running contrary to the fact that God was protecting them? No. In South Carolina, is it a law by the state that we have to, where if you're going to ride a motorcycle, do you have to put a helmet on? Not in our state. And at most any given time, you could go over to Richland Hospital, the trauma unit, and see somebody. I mean, I had to go there a lot when I was in residency, and I don't know if I ever went in there where there wasn't at least one motorcycle rider that was in there with a big head injury where an accident occurred and they didn't have a helmet on. You don't have to wear a helmet here, but there's all kinds of statistics and numbers about what happens, you know, what the effects of wearing a helmet or not. Well, if you get on a motorcycle, you're not legally required to do that. We said, well, it's up to God whether or not my head bursts open if I hit the, you know, if I have a wreck and what happens. And do we do that and just say we don't need to wear a helmet? What about taking medicines? I have lots of people that seem to have that attitude. Well, my health is in God's hands. Does that mean, well, then we don't need to take any medicines if we have a sickness? I mean, just, is that what God teaches? Or does God require or expect us to do certain things when he gives us the ability or the knowledge about things and to take measures? Well, you know, clearly that's the case. As Jesus hid himself, Elijah got out of there. That was the prudent thing to do. I mean, can it affect what God decides to do with our life depending on some of the choices we make if we're going to be foolish? We can get ourselves in a situation where tempting the Lord, might he say then, okay, if that's where you're going to be, I'll take your life now, where otherwise he might not. If Elijah just sat there in Jezreel and not moved, that might have ended up differently. But of course he didn't, because he had wisdom. So he knew there was a danger there, so he got away from it. The Lord gave him that opportunity. Now, if there was no way, if he were trapped in there and he couldn't, there was no way to get out of that situation, could the Lord have saved him another way? Of course. God has the power to do that. That's his will. But he had a way out. God gave him a means to escape then, and he took it, and he got out of there. And he went down to Beersheba. So was that a wise or foolish thing to do? That was a wise thing to do, to get as far away as you could get from Jezebel as possible at that moment in time. And so he used wisdom there, which in no way was taking away from the fact or showing any kind of a lack of faith in the fact that God was the one taking care of him. Well, was this a way that God did take care of him to get him out of there, provide him a way out of there to get him to Beersheba? Well, yes. And so that's where he went. And he had his, then he left his servant there. But then, as we start to read in verse 4, Elijah didn't just stay there in Beersheba. He went and went out into the wilderness. Let's go ahead and read verses 4 through 8 to see where he went next and what happened there. 1 Kings 19, verses 4 through 8. And just before we read that, so, I mean, that's why, I mean, we understand with this virus thing going around, I mean, can I make myself not get it? No more than anybody else can, but, I mean, should I wash my hands? And being a physician in a hospital where more than likely we're going to have cases in there, should I wear the protective gear that they've given me? That would be it. So doing things like that, that's not showing a lack of faith. That's being prudent and wise as we need to be. But all right, let's let's go ahead and read 4 through 8 here in 1 Kings 19, see what happens next. Let's see. Do you have that, Brother Marshall? Or,
sorry.
1 Kings 19, 4 through 8. Kings 19, 4 to 8.
But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die and said, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers." And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink, and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time, and touched him, and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." And he arose, and did eat and drink, and went of the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto the Horeb, the Mount of God.
Okay, so here's another example of the power of God and how God was saving him in this situation. So Elijah, he did his part. He took the way of escape God gave him to get out of Jezreel. And now he leaves Beersheba and he goes a day's journey out into the wilderness. So he's heading out here. You know, Vic, you get over here, what's over in this area?
Egypt.
Yeah, well, if you go far enough, you're going to get... But what's in between Beersheba and Egypt? Well, that wilderness area where Sinai is, where the Israelites were after they left Egypt. That's where he ends up going. And as it mentions there, the last part of verse 8 there, unto Horeb, the Mount of God. So he's going to end up right there at the mountain where God gave the law to Moses. But he's going out in the wilderness. Well, the conditions in that wilderness and Elijah's time any different than they had been for his forefathers back in the time after the Exodus when they wandered around there? What was the problem that was in that area then? And how did God fix it? Yeah, no food or water. It's a wilderness. It's a desert. So he gave them manna. He gave them water from the rocks. Well, Elijah is... he goes out into the wilderness a day's journey. Sits down under a juniper tree. And then... requests that he might die. So does he recognize that his soul is in God's hand? Yes, and he's actually asking God to take it. Now later on, there's another prophet a notable prophet that we will probably think of who made the same request. Who was that?
Jonah.
Very good. When he was being blasted by the heat from that east wind when he was sitting outside of Nineveh hoping to see it get destroyed. So he was in a different area for different reasons, but he was physically uncomfortable, but also very discouraged and disappointed about what had happened there at Nineveh. God, of course, was teaching him a lesson from that. But anyway, he also made the same request. Well, it got denied in both cases for Elijah here and later for Jonah. God didn't take their lives at that point in time. So he's asking God to take his life. Well, Job did too. That's another one. So there are a few that got in a situation where it was so discouraging, very desperate, and they were ready to die. And so he said it was enough for God to take away his life at that time. And he said he was not better than his fathers. And then he lay down and went to sleep, but he didn't lie down and die. Because it was not God's will. So what did God do? I mean, here he is out in the wilderness. So he's God provided for him through the famine. Now he's out here in the wilderness. Still he's running for his life. So we take the brethren that are prophets as brethren. We take the prophets for an example, as we're told to in James 5:11. Well, here we have Elijah. We also mentioned when we started studying about him what a great example he is of suffering, affliction, and of endurance. Well, here he is again. I mean, and right after, I mean, what a great moment that was there in 1 Kings 18 when God bore that witness that he did and sending that fire down, and all the people are saying Jehovah is God, and then these false prophets of Baal have now been put to death. I mean, that was a glorious moment in chapter 18, and then quickly, now he's out here in the wilderness alone, and no food or water around, and I mean, it goes from a very high point to a very low point almost instantly. So he didn't see the point of him being around any longer, and he thinks he's the only one left. So he thinks all that was in vain and for nothing, as we're going to see. But God knew better, and Elijah and he endured. I mean, he didn't go and kill himself, did he? He didn't do something wrong. But from what he could see in the situation, he didn't see the reason why there was any for him to be on the earth any longer. So he was ready and willing to die, but it was not God's will yet. God had a lot more work for Elijah to do, for him personally, but also for the sake of Israel. And so God sent an angel. And so he sent an angel who touched him and told him to get up and eat. And so there was a cake baked on coals there with a cruse of water at his head. And he ate and drank, and he lay down again. And so then the angel came a second time and said to get up and eat, because the journey was going to be too great for him. So he was going to be traveling, and he needed strength from the food for his journey. And he ate and drank, and then that meal sustained him for how long? That's a pretty good meal right there. Try that at Sheely's. I mean, 40 days and 40 nights off of, I know we got some guys back here near the back row that can hardly make it 40 minutes after one, but can you believe that? 40 days and 40 nights off of one meal there. How did that meal get provided? And how was it able to sustain him physically for that length of time? And this was all from God. Well, God had already done that during the famine. I mean, he had birds bringing, the ravens bringing his food twice a day while he was there until that brook dried up. And then he had that daily miracle to sustain that the provisions there in Zarephath at that widow's house. So God had already done so much to sustain him through those years of the famine. Now it's over. The famine's ended. Now here he is out in the wilderness. I mean, it's not hard to see why he would have been very discouraged about these circumstances. But now God sends an angel and provides what he needs through his angel. So here's the demonstration, the proof that his life was in God's hand and God was providing. Now, he was providing in ways, I mean, this isn't going to happen to us, but it does show the point that God was taking care of him and God's hand wasn't shortened. God will take care of us one way or another. He's going to get his will done. We need to do our part in seeking him and seeking him and serving him diligently. And that's why we need to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live or do this or that, but then leave the rest of it in his hands. He'll take care of it. You know how much that removes from our shoulders as far as the burden of being anxious and worrying about things? Do we really need to be tied up with anxiety about, well, what's going to happen here and what's going to happen there and all of that? That doesn't mean that we don't make preparations and when God makes something known to us, that we search his word and use whatever is in that situation to try to apply that and do his will in every situation. That is our job. That's our task. But past that, we don't have to worry about all these things. We don't have to worry about what people are planning and plotting and or anything else for that matter. I mean, some people get all worried about, well, you know, some asteroid that might end up hitting the Earth or something. I mean, do we have to worry about that? Just think about all the things we don't have to worry about because we're a Christian. Because we understand what who's in control. And all that's taken away from us. We're freed up. That's why I said, if we seek first His kingdom and righteousness, He's going to find a way to take care of our food, drink, and clothes. He'll meet our needs. We don't have to be consumed with worry about all those kinds of things. We can concentrate on what we're here for, and that's seeking God. And then He's going to take care of everything else. So here's Elijah as proof of that. So God has great plans for him. Feeds him by His angel with something that's going to sustain him for 40 days and 40 nights. All the way to Horeb, the Mount of God. Well, that 40 days and 40 nights and Horeb, the Mount of God, that has an association, doesn't it? Well, how long was Moses up there in that mount? 40 days and 40 nights. So there's some significance to that particular location and number. And so he's going to be hiding in a cave out there for a time. But then, God, it's not God's will, and God's work for Elijah is not for him to be sitting around in a cave for however long. So he's got him out of that situation, but he's got Elijah on the earth at that time for some good reasons and good purposes, and not for him just to be sitting in a cave. So he had work to do for the Lord, and so God is going to get him out of there and get him to where he needed to be, to do what he needed to do. So we will pick it up there from verse 9, Lord willing, next week, as we are out of time this morning.